Welcome to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. I'm Amanda Schager. In November 2012, Derechos Humanos held their 9th annual Corazón de Justicia Awards Banquet, in which they celebrate and recognize community organizers for their commitment to justice and social change. The keynote speaker for the event was Rob Williams, the E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies and faculty co-chair of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. His latest book is Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization. First up on 30 Minutes, we hear from Derechos Humanos co-chair Isabel Garcia with an introduction of Rob Williams, followed by Rob Williams with an overview of some of the findings in his book.
Muy buenas noches. Thank you so much for coming to this beautiful place. Pretty nice, right? Beautiful. I really want to welcome you and remind you why we have this event. We started really over 8 years ago. We knew back from really the Manzo days and the La Mesilla organizing project, and then we became Derechos Humanos, that our work was all of your work. We just didn't know it. They keep us working in silos. The environmentalists work to keep Mother Nature preserved. The indigenous keep everybody preserved. The LGBTQ community fighting the really good fights. Labor unions creating more and more middle class is what they did. And on, you can see the list. And we knew that we had to have a night of celebration to really celebrate all of our friends and to acknowledge that our fight is your fight and your fight is our fight. And we, I think, are realizing it more than ever. Tonight is really fitting that we are on Indian lands and that we have a Native American author, speaker, professor, lawyer who will talk to us about what the world is realizing, and that is that we should all go back and listen to the indigenous as we would have a better place. This world would be a better place if we did so. And so I'm really proud to be with all of you here. We not only acknowledge and recognize our champions of justice in this community, which is very important to do, and you've seen the list. There's many of you who have been honored here before, but Derechos Humanos is... we're a lot of things, but we're one thing, too. We're about education. And so every year that we have this event, we take great pride in finding somebody who can, who really can share knowledge. And this evening, we are very honored to have somebody that lives here in Tucson. We have a treasure here in Tucson. And I'm going to read here before I go on a lot. Rob Williams is the E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies, faculty co-chair of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the U of A Rogers College of Law. As an enrolled member of the Lumbee Indian Tribe of North Carolina, Professor Williams received his BA from Loyola College, his JD from Harvard Law. He was named the first Oneida Indian Nation visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School, having previously served there as Bennett Bosky Distinguished Visiting Lecturer of Law. He is the author of The American Indian in Western Legal Thought, The Discourses of Conquest, which received the Gustavus Myers Human Rights Center Award as one of the outstanding books published in 1990 on the subject of prejudice in the United States. He also has written Linking Arms Together, American Indian Treaty Visions of Law and Peace, 1600 through 1800, and Like a Loaded Weapon, The Rehnquist Court, Indian Rights, and the Legal History of Racism in America. He is co-author of Federal Indian Law, Cases and Materials, And his latest book is Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization, which he will talk about tonight. He has received major awards, and foundations have given him major grants. He has represented tribal groups before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Peoples, and served as co-counsel for Floyd Hicks in the United States Supreme Court, Nevada versus Hicks. Rob was named one of 2011's Heroes on the Hill by Indian Country Today for his work on behalf of the Hulkumnum Treaty Group before the OAS Inter-American Rights Commission. He is also, in his spare time, a musician mixing his guitar at home, and just recently has become a gardener and a salsa dancer, all because he is so nice to his wife, who is a research attorney in my office, Joy Williams. He's a wonderful husband and my good friend, Rob Williams.
I'll hold it. Am I hurt? Thank you. Thank you so much for that invitation. And thank you to Coalition Derechos Humanos, and particularly to Kat Rodriguez and to Isabel for inviting me to speak to you this evening. I'm greatly honored and humbled to be here before you. As Isabel said, my talk tonight is based on my latest book. The book is about what I call the most dangerous idea in the history of Western civilization. The idea of the savage, and it traces that idea going back all the way to the Greeks and Romans. This idea of the savage as applied to American Indian tribes and indigenous peoples, but is also applied to many other minority groups in this country and around the world by the West. And my basic argument is, in fact, if you look at the history of Western civilization for 3,000 years, it basically invented itself around the idea of the savage. In fact, without the idea of the savage, Western civilization would not exist. This idea of the savage is contained in one of the languages of racism that we all know about in the United States. The idea of a language of racism I borrowed from Malcolm X. For those of you who may have read the autobiography of Malcolm X, it's voted one of the 10 most influential books of the 20th century by Time magazine. It was written by Alex Haley, who also wrote the book Roots. After spending a year with Malcolm, he was so confused about who he was, he needed to go all the way back to Africa to figure it out. He was quite an extraordinary human being, and Haley's book is just one of the great autobiographies. At the end of the book, there's an epilogue where Haley talks about what it was like to spend time with this extraordinary man and civil rights leader. And he says, I remember one incident within the airport that showed me Malcolm never lost his racial perspective. Waiting for my baggage, we witnessed a touching family reunion, as part of which several cherubic little children romped and played, exclaiming in another language. By tomorrow night, they'll know how to say their first English word, the N-word, Malcolm observed. How many people need help filling in the blanks with the N-word? We all know that language of racism, that language of segregation and of lynching and of subordination that goes back to the founding of this country. And Malcolm teaches us that we need to be alert to the fact that every American, whether they're born here or comes to these shores, in fact, everybody in the Western world knows these languages of racism and lives with these languages. Think about the languages of racism that are associated with the Mexican in the American racial imagination. And these languages are not only words, but are images which are driven into our minds and our imaginations at a very young age. They become part of our cultural DNA. The sleeping Mexican, the Cisco kid, hey Poncho, the OC Weekly column, Ask a Mexican, in which a Mexican-American columnist takes questions from ignorant white people who don't understand anything about Mexicans to demolish the stereotypes. And then, of course, the history of oppression associated with our immigration policies, the language of racism which used the word wetback to describe Mexicans. And, of course, how many of us went to school and had our Fritos stolen and somebody would say, I am the Frito Bandito. These are these racist stereotypes and demeaning images that we learn from a very young age. And, in fact, the latest stereotype, of course, is of the angry Mexican trying to get something here from good red-blooded American citizens. This is a picture, of course, of the demonstration at the TUSD school board. And Unidos and the great work they did, trying to fight that language of racism. We are all familiar with these languages of racism. During World War II, the American government decided to lock up Japanese Americans in concentration camps. In the very famous Supreme Court case of Korematsu versus United States, a 6-3 majority said, because we know that there's a potential that these Japanese Americans might be subversives, the Army has the power and the President has the power to lock these people up without due process. And the language of racism that was used to justify that decision was focused on by one of the dissents, Justice Murphy, that this forced exclusion was the result in good measure of this erroneous assumption of racial guilt, rather than bona fide military necessity, is evidenced by the commanding general's final report. In it, he refers to all individuals of Japanese descent as subversive, as belonging to an enemy race whose racial strains are undiluted. Individuals of Japanese ancestry are condemned because they are said to be a large, unassimilated, tightly knit racial group, bound to an enemy nation by strong ties of race, culture, and religion. And that language of racism was sanctioned by the Supreme Court and became the law of the land, that a language of racism can be used to lock up American citizens because they're perceived as being a threat to the dominant society. We all know a language of racism when it comes to American Indians. I call it the Americanized language of savagery. It goes back to the colonial era. In 1820, the three most popular books in the United States were King James Bible, Blackstone's Commentaries, and the Captivity Narratives of Mary Rowlandson. So even those Harlequin romances are nothing new. They've been around forever. And this idea of Indians, for example, capturing whites and taking their scalps and burning them at the stake was the subject of dime store novels and comic books. And again, these are the languages that Americans speak and learn from a very early age. I can't tell you how many times I tell people I'm a Lumbee and they say, well, you don't look like a real Indian. I know what a real Indian looks like. Everybody speaks these languages of racism. You all speak it and you don't even know it. I want you to close your eyes and think of a young Indian woman. I want you to close your eyes and now open them. Did she look like this? How many people know who that is? Raise your hand. You all know this language. It's Disney's Pocahontas. Now I want you to close your eyes and think of a young Indian man. Just close your eyes. Does he look like this guy? I was up on the reservation in Montana, and when I showed this picture, one of the aunties in the back said, where's he at? Where do we find him? I said, you don't understand, that's a stereotype. Aw, darn. Go home and ask your children or your grandchildren or your little brother and sister to speak two words of Indian. They will know two words. That is, ugh and how, right? Peter Pan, how many people saw Peter Pan when they were a kid? And the racist, of course you all saw it. Those are the languages of racism that we speak, the language of savagery. It's the only language you know.
You are listening to UA Law Professor Rob Williams' keynote address at Derechos Humanos 9th Annual Corazón de Justicia Awards Banquet, held in November 2012.
Some of you may have followed the interesting controversy with Elizabeth Warren and whether or not she looked like an Indian. And Senator Scott Brown, in the first debate, said, does she look like an Indian to you? Now, if she had asked for my advice, I'd have told her to dress differently. Does she look like an Indian now? Or what about this woman? Does she look like an Indian? That's the Victoria's Secret model, white woman, very famous, Carly Kloss, who appeared in Victoria's Secret's fashion show last week wearing a Sioux headdress. Those feathers are only earned for acts of valor or bravery or courage, and it was a huge insult to the Plains tribes to wear that headdress, and there were so many complaints that Victoria's Secret said, we will not be showing this. They didn't know that that was part of a language of racism. That's what the psychological and behavioral psychologist and cognitive psychologists tell us, that we speak this language as part of our normal everyday go walking about in the world, that we don't even realize how it's full of stereotypes and cliches. So to prove to you that you all speak this language of racism, I just want you to turn to your partner or somebody next to you and name a famous Indian chief. Go ahead, name a famous Indian chief that you know. All right, how many people, raise your hand, how many people named this guy, Sitting Bull? Keep your hand up. How many people named this guy, Geronimo? How many people named this guy, Crazy Horse? Now, this is the Crazy Horse monument that some crazy German family is carving out of a mountain. And that's what it's supposed to look like. And I was out there, and I was sort of, you know, talking. My family was there and sort of talking about Crazy Horse. And this little old blue-haired white lady comes up to me and says, Mister, you sound like you know a lot. Who is that man up on Crazy Horse? I knew it was going to be a long haul, but I keep trying. How many people could name a famous dead Indian chief that killed somebody, a white person, in the 19th century? Raise your hand. Those are the only Indian chiefs you know. Anybody who knows, how many people could raise their hand, could knew an Indian chief? Raise your hand. You all speak this language. I'll give you absolution afterwards tonight. You'll feel better. How many people know who this is? Okay. So think about it. More of you know a famous dead Indian chief who killed white people than the chairman of the Tohono O'odham Nation right next door to us, Ned Norris. That's because we don't speak this language. Americans do not speak this language of contemporary concerns of tribal people and their contemporary problems and their contemporary leaders. What we know is this language of racism and savagery that goes back to the 17th and 18th century. Now, the point is that the cognitive psychologist and behavioral psychologists who studied stereotyping tell us that by the time a child is 3 years old, they've learned these negative stereotypes. There's been a lot of research at Stanford University. One of the most famous studies was by Phyllis Katz, and this is from my book. I describe this literature. The psychologist Phyllis Katz produced one of the most compelling examples of the perniciousness and deeply entrenched nature of the stereotyping process at work in a young child's mind in her groundbreaking research published in 1976. Katz tells the story of observing a 3-year-old white child who's seeing a black infant for the first time while peering into a baby carriage, says to her mother, "Look, Mom, a baby made." Do you realize that child's cognitive DNA has been hardwired with those stereotypes? The literature and the research shows you can never erase those stereotypes. Surprise, surprise. Children who are raised in a house where the N-word is used are likely to be much more highly prejudiced against African Americans than in a house where it's not used. This is just common sense, what we know. And so, of course, how many of you have played in teepees? Or I remember one time my daughter came home and she had an assignment to build a traditional Indian house. And I said, what was that? What the teacher suggests? Oh, you know, a wigwam, a hogan, a teepee. And I said, no, get me a shoebox and some tires off that little model car and a black magic marker. I attached the wheels to the shoebox. I said, this is a Section 8 housing trailer. This is mold because the government doesn't take care of it. That's housing on the reservation. Get a call. The teacher wants an intervention, okay? But this is the thing, we incorporate these languages, we expose our children to these stereotypes, and this is the only thing they know about Indians, and this is true of every other minority group. It's true of women, it's true of gays. It's one of the most common functions of human psychology is to identify and label the other as different, alien, and strange. Now, interestingly, one of my colleagues, Stephanie Freiberg, a Native American psychologist, studied at Stanford, wanted to specifically see what the effects of these stereotypes were, not only on Native people, but on non-Native people. She took 100 kids up in Gallup, 50 Indian kids, Navajo kids, 50 white kids. And she sat them down and she showed each group some prompts. So the first group of 25 white kids, or like 12 white kids and 12 Indian kids, saw Pocahontas. That's it. The second group, how many people know what that is? You all speak that language. Even if you're not sports fans, you recognize that's Chief Wahoo from the Cleveland Indians. A highly racially offensive mascot to many Native Americans, oftentimes the subject of bitter complaint, yet nobody seems to care. But change the context a little bit, and how would you feel, for example, if that's what Chief Wahoo looked like? What the research shows is we've become habituated. We become used to. We accept these stereotypes as normal, as the way the world is. And of course, it shapes our perception of the way we think about other peoples. So the Indian and non-Indian kids, one group was shown Chief Wahoo. A third great group was just given a little card with some information on it. Suicide rates are the highest for any ethnic group amongst American Indians. Alcoholism rates of enormous proportions. They were just given that information. And then the fourth group was the control group. They got nothing. Then Stephanie gave these kids a basic high school self-esteem test. Counselors use it. Kids not getting good grades. You want to find out why. Maybe they've got acne breakout. Maybe they can't find a girlfriend or boyfriend. You give them this self-esteem test. It's been normed over hundreds of thousands of times. It's a very reliable indicator of teenage self-esteem in the here and now. And it's interesting. In fact, she wasn't very much surprised by what she found with the non-Indian, with the Indian kids, who were given this self-esteem test. The kids in the control group on the right, the highest blue column, their self-esteem wasn't affected. That's because they weren't exposed to these negative stereotypes. But look at what happens to the Indian kids who are exposed to the stereotype of the drunken, suicidal Indian. Their self-esteem dips well below the norm. The Indian kids who are shown Chief Wahoo, of course, have the lowest self-esteem score because it's such a degrading stereotype. And then the Indian kids, particularly the Indian girls who see Pocahontas with all those things about body image, drives down their self-esteem as well. Not surprising, confirms what we know, that these stereotypes work to oppress the outsider groups, to make them feel bad about themselves. In fact, what the research shows is you perform down to your stereotype. But what was really interesting was what Stephanie found with the white kids. Their self-esteem is increased by being exposed to the stereotypes. They feel better about themselves. They are empowered by these negative stereotypes of others. Now, in my book, what I try to do is figure out where this language of savagery comes from. And what you find is that the West has been speaking this language for over 3,000 years. How many people here have read Homer's Iliad or Odyssey at one time? Everybody. Do you understand that virtually every educated person in the history of the Western world for 3,000 years has been exposed to Homer's Iliad and Odyssey? And it's full of stories of Greek warrior heroes going off to foreign lands and conquering savage, barbarian tribes, monsters, people like the Cyclops, the one-eyed tribe of monsters on the far seas that Odysseus blinds. And if you read Homer, the language he uses to identify the savages, their lack of laws, their lack of political institutions, their lack of sophisticated economies, their focus on hunting and farming rather than on commercial enterprise and agriculture, designates them as inferior people. And what you find is the Romans, for example, built great monuments celebrating their victories over the barbarian tribes of Europe, who are depicted in long hair and unkempt dress and basically barbarian savage peoples. The great battle monuments throughout Rome celebrate these victories. And so what I try to show is that from the Roman Empire onward, the West has been absorbed with this language of savagery to use an instrument of oppression. We see this language used during the Crusades against the Muslims in the Holy Land. We see this language used by Columbus when he sails to the New World and encounters the indigenous peoples, the Arawaks, in the Caribbean. We see this language used by George Washington and the founders. Thomas Jefferson writes in the Declaration of Independence that one of the reasons justifying the revolution against the king is that he's brought on the merciless Indian savages whose known mode of warfare is the indiscriminate killing of all women and children. And so this language of savagery continues to the reservation policy of the 19th century, and it continues into the 20th century in the decisions of the Supreme Court. In 1978, as I explain in my book, Justice Rehnquist, in an opinion called Oliphant v. Suquamish Tribes, said Indian tribes are not sophisticated enough to criminally prosecute whites who come onto the reservation and commit crimes against Indian people. Now, the result of that decision has been to create a jurisdictional vacuum in Indian country, because if the tribe can't prosecute crimes against Indian women of sexual assault and domestic violence, the only other entity that can is the U.S. Attorney. The U.S. Attorney doesn't play very well with rape kits. The U.S. Attorney doesn't like to investigate sexual assault on the reservation. That's not how you move up in the U.S. Attorney's office. You move up by doing RICO and immigration bust and drug bust. And so the declination of prosecution rates in Indian country by the federal government is significantly higher, by a factor of 3 to 4 times higher. In fact, Amnesty International cites a crisis in Indian country of sexual violence and abuse, citing the Department of Justice's own statistics that 1 in 3 American Indian women will be raped during her lifetime, and that 86% of those cases, the perpetrator is a non-Indian. On border towns and in many communities, non-Indians recognize it's a no man's land, with tribes disempowered because they're not sophisticated enough to operate a legal system that we can be sure will treat whites fairly who come onto their reservation and assault their citizens. And so that language of savagery, which we're all familiar with, the language that UNIDOS fights, the language of racism that the plaintiffs in the Tucson desegregation case fight, the languages of racism that an organization like Derechos Humanos fights, all of us are united in a coalition against these languages of racism, these languages of savagery. And I'm honored here to be here with you tonight to share my story, the language of savagery and the language of racism that continues to afflict the human rights of indigenous peoples. Thank you very much.
That was Rob Williams, the E. Thomas Sullivan Professor of Law and American Indian Studies and faculty co-chair of the Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. His latest book is Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization. He was the keynote speaker at Derechos Humanos' 9th Annual Corazón de Justicia Awards Banquet, held in November 2012. Thank you for listening to 30 Minutes on 91.3 KXCI Tucson. I'm Amanda Shager.